This is Jorge Fascinetti, and you are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Today I'm here with Dr. Lewis Blevins, and we're going to talk about the clinical presentation of pituitary disorders and how physicians sort through the many, many number of symptoms and signs and make clinical decisions about how to proceed. This is a subject that is really of great interest to our audience, so I think it would be really interesting for all of us to understand and hear your perspectives on this. So, Dr. Blevins, could you give us an overview of what's going through your mind and the things that you have to consider when a patient comes to you with a history of pituitary disease or the possibility of a pituitary problem?
Well, Jorge, that's a difficult one to answer. As you know, an approach to the practice of medicine is developed over time, not only through training through medical school, residency, and fellowship, but also through clinical practice. And you know, I've spent tens of thousands of hours over the past more than a quarter of a century evaluating patients with pituitary disorders. And I would have to say that the approach to the patient incorporates an understanding of normal physiology and anatomy, the factors that lead to hormone release by the pituitary gland, the effects that those hormones have from the pituitary on target gland tissues, and in turn the effects that those target gland hormones have on tissues, but also understanding the pathophysiology of the different diseases that can affect the pituitary unit, the natural history of those diseases, for example, whether it might be early or late stage disease, the different processes, whether it be tumor, inflammation, or some other way to disrupt pituitary function. And then, of course, we're also thinking as we're evaluating the patient what might be clinically relevant and clinically significant.
I see. So what do you mean by clinically relevant?
Well, I think that it basically means that something might be relevant to the disease state at hand. For example, if a patient with acromegaly complains of arthralgias and arthritis, that's obviously a relevant finding. But if a patient with a pituitary cyst complains of arthralgias and arthritis, that's not relevant in that it's not related to the underlying disease process. So as physicians, we have to determine what is the relevance of the different symptoms and signs that the patient presents with so that we can sort of incorporate those into our diagnosis plan and ultimately into our treatment plan.
So it sounds like there's a bit of a difference between relevance and significance. What do you mean by clinical significance?
Clinical significance basically relates to the fact that how significant is a disorder or a problem. So, for example, if someone has headaches, and you know, one-third of all people have headaches, but if they have headaches and they have a 3-millimeter pituitary lesion, it's not likely that that lesion is significant and related to the headaches. On the other hand, sometimes having a small or otherwise thought to be inconsequential pituitary lesion can be very significant to a patient, especially if it results in concerns about health and psychological problems as a result of a finding of a small pituitary tumor, for example. That would be a clinically significant lesion. That doesn't mean it will be treated, because sometimes we would recommend follow-up in that setting, but it means it's significant and it's affected the patient's life due to the fact that it's present.
Okay, I see. Relevance and significance. That makes sense. So arriving at a diagnosis is more than just simply trying to figure out what the patient has. You have to sort through a number of symptoms and signs that may or may not be relevant to the diagnosis or significant in regards to the patient when you are trying to formulate the healthcare plan. I see. Something that is relevant is pertinent to the patient in front of you. It should be noted or considered. Significance, on the other hand, denotes importance. Something significant is indeed important to the issue at hand. I suppose that's what separates an experienced practitioner from, let's say, a less experienced practitioner who may or may not recognize the significance of what the patient is saying. Maybe another way to look at it is an observation or a sign may be relevant and worth considering, but at the end, it may not be significant to the diagnosis. Wow, there seems to be a real balancing act here that you have to consider when you analyze what a patient is telling you. So, okay, you have a patient in your office. What are you thinking? How are you going to proceed?
Well, the first thing we want to look at is why was the patient referred? What's the chief complaint, if you will, or the main problem or the reason for the question? Obviously, I'm a super subspecialist, I suppose, since I'm an endocrinologist who focuses only on pituitary disorders and the target gland dysfunctions. So most people come to me with a very specific question. Do I have this disease? Or my doctor diagnosed this disease. What do we do next, for example? So we start to look at what's the original reason for the visit, and then we look at how did that particular patient present. In other words, how did that disease process present itself and sort itself out to separate itself from other symptoms and signs that we all have as human beings? So we look at the presentation, the pattern, the full spectrum of symptoms and signs, and we're sorting through relevance at that stage. So, for example, if someone has sleep apnea, but they have no evidence of acromegaly, they might have hypothyroidism accounting for that sleep apnea. So we're trying to sort through all of those things while we're trying to piece together what's going on with the particular patient. We're also interested in the overall health of the patient and other disease processes and medical problems, because sometimes other medical problems can give you a clue to what the underlying diagnosis with the pituitary disease would be. And certainly the timing of the presentation can give you a clue as well.
Well, how do you sort through all the information, which I presume is voluminous, and organize it as it comes to you when you're talking to a patient in the examining room?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that most of us who've practiced medicine for a while do it naturally. And I think the way the human brain works, we sort things and we compartmentalize them. You know, whether we're talking about the weather or colors or cars, for example, I think physicians treat medical problems the same way. And we might compartmentalize, for example, acromegaly, knowing all about acromegaly, and go through a list of symptoms and signs that might be related to that. Same thing for prolactinomas or Cushing's or non-functioning pituitary tumors or inflammation of the pituitary and so on.
Okay, that's really interesting. So give me an idea how you do that. How do you compartmentalize a patient that has a pituitary tumor?
Okay, well, let's assume a patient comes to me with a pituitary tumor. So as I'm going through my history and physical, I want the patient to tell me how they presented and how they were diagnosed. And then I'm going to backtrack a bit, and I'm going to compartmentalize my line of questioning. I'm going to ask whether or not that patient presented with certain mass effects. And for pituitary adenomas, those generally include headache, any number of different patterns of visual loss, and other symptoms that might be related to the mass of the tumor, such as double vision, if there's invasion of the cavernous sinus and compression of the nerves that control the eye muscles. And rarely patients might have nosebleeds due to invasion of the nasopharynx. And sometimes patients have nasal stuffiness, as did a recent patient who had a tumor that had invaded the back of his nose. So those are the mass effects, and those are the principal ones that we're concerned about in patients with pituitary tumors. And then I look for symptoms and signs of hormone excess. So it's a few specific questions about each of the hormone excess states, such as acromegaly, Cushing's, hyperthyroidism, prolactin excess, for example. And oftentimes it takes one or two questions in each one of those categories to sort out. And we're obviously asking questions based on what we see, too. So if I see a patient who does not look acromegalic, I'm not likely to ask too many questions about acromegaly, for example. And then we're also sort of compartmentalizing the hormone dysfunctions as well. And then the next would be to evaluate for symptoms and signs of other disease processes that might affect the pituitary gland, such as sarcoidosis or lymphocytic hypophysitis or metastatic tumor and so on. So we're thinking, I should say, alive or in a dynamic fashion while we're listening to a patient. And we're listening at the same time formulating our next questions and sorting through relevance and significance and trying to arrive at a diagnosis, and also starting to think about what we can do to help a person along the way.
That sounds complicated and rather difficult, especially as complex as pituitary disease is. And what about patients when there is a diminished hormone secretion or hypopituitarism? I know that more than one hormone can be affected in that setting. How do you actually sort through that possibility, especially with all the symptoms and signs that can result when a pituitary gland acts up and either fails to produce one or more of its hormones, or it doesn't produce enough of them?
Well, Jorge, that's very insightful. And as you know, hypopituitarism is complex. It can be partial or complete, and it can involve one or more of the pituitary hormones. And the best way to approach it is to basically look at each of the target glands that the pituitary controls and ask a few questions related to dysfunction of those particular areas or arenas. So, for example, symptoms of adrenal insufficiency, symptoms of hypothyroidism, symptoms of gonadal deficiency, for example, symptoms of growth hormone deficiency. So we compartmentalize and subcategorize in that realm as well. And again, if a patient does not look hypopituitary, we probably wouldn't spend a lot of time asking questions. Or if we have prior pituitary function studies that are normal, we probably wouldn't ask any questions. So for example, if a patient comes to me with normal thyroid hormone levels or normal testosterone levels, or a woman is having normal menses, I'm not going to explore those areas. And that's not just because it's of interest in time, but it's irrelevant. So it gets back to that relevance problem or situation, and it's using time wisely. I think of a question as a diagnostic test, and sometimes diagnostic tests are indicated and sometimes they're not. And if you have totally normal thyroid functions, it's unlikely that we'll spend time talking about symptoms and signs of hypo or hyperthyroidism. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, but it sounds really difficult. I would assume that all of this is critical as you apply your experience, knowledge that you acquire over the years, and add to that factual information to offer a patient the right levels of replacement hormones. Let's talk about the case of hypopituitarism that we're discussing here, so that patient can get on with a normal life. It seems clear as you uncover clues, those clues take you on a specific path depending on what you see and hear. It seems to me you really have to practice medicine with a lot of intuition based on years of experience.
Well, Jorge, you're exactly right. There's no substitute to experience and a good fund of knowledge that's gained through experience, but also through reading medical papers, textbooks, etc. And we use that experience and that knowledge to determine the relevance and the clinical significance of the symptoms and signs and laboratory studies and radiographic studies that are presented to us at the time of a visit with a patient.
That's great. So, okay, let's shift a bit here and talk about those symptoms and signs that are common from one illness to another. For example, tiredness, weakness, and fatigue are things that you might see with pituitary disease in any one of the hormone excess or deficiencies with patients with heart disease, liver disease, or kidney disease might have the same symptoms and signs. I guess the point is that these signs and symptoms you see are not significant or directly related to pituitary disease and could potentially be due to lots of other different processes.
Yes, that's correct. Symptoms and signs of pituitary disorders are very nonspecific, meaning they're not specific to pituitary diseases and can be seen in other disease processes. And that's the big conundrum. That's why patients sometimes present with symptoms and signs of pituitary disorders and aren't diagnosed for a while, because the physicians usually try to ascribe it to something else. And it in my mind, explains the mystery of the delay in the diagnosis in most of the patients that we see. Pituitary diseases are uncommon. Other things are more common, and physicians are programmed, if you will, to think of the common things and the more likely things first, and the uncommon things last. The analogies often used are horses are more common than zebras. So if you hear hoofbeats, look for horses. But sometimes it's a zebra coming down your path, and you need to recognize that. And I think the truly astute clinicians do recognize the zebras and can recognize when the hoof beats are different, if you will, from a usual trot of a horse coming down the lane. And that's something that comes with time and experience and practice. But again, pituitary diseases are uncommon. Some physicians have never seen a case of acromegaly. In fact, most physicians have probably never seen a case of acromegaly, whereas endocrinologists might see an occasional case. Some endocrinologists might see 3 to 4 cases of acromegaly their entire career. It's something I do for a living, so they seem to be pretty evident and obvious to me, but they wouldn't be to other physicians who don't have that clinical experience. And this really works both ways. There are patients who have had long-standing symptoms and signs that indicate that they had pituitary disease for a while, and there are other patients who have symptoms and signs that they want to attribute to the pituitary disease once they figured out they have a pituitary problem, but they're simply not related because either hormone levels are normal or the symptoms and signs aren't usually something we see within the spectrum of pituitary disorders in the first place. The converse is true. Sometimes patients come to us with acromegaly and minimal symptoms and signs, and other times patients come to us with florid symptoms and signs of acromegaly, but there's no pituitary tumor, their growth hormone dynamics are normal, and their IGF-1 level is entirely normal. So that sort of is a bit of an unusual commentary on symptoms and signs and how common they are and how uncommon the disease processes are, but it can lead to some difficulty in diagnosis and in sorting through the relevance and determining the clinical significance that we had talked about earlier.
Boy, that makes a ton of sense to me. The horse and the zebra analogy is so on and on target, because it is only with experience that you can tell the difference, really. I would add to that awareness that these disorders actually exist can lead a not too experienced clinician to at least suspect it. And like you have said, put it on the list of possibilities. I think that alone could help diagnose a lot of people. And that it is really what job one is for us at Pituitary World News. Put it on the radar so doctors know it exists and can at least consider the possibility that what they are seeing could be a pituitary disorder. Excuse me. I can also honestly say I have a much better appreciation for the difficulties in evaluation and management of patients in general, but also those with rare disorders like pituitary disorders. It also speaks of the importance of having physicians with experience and knowledge in pituitary disorders and seeking those physicians that are most qualified and educated that one can find. So, well, this is great. Really amazing information that I know our audience will truly appreciate. So thank you, Dr. Blevins, for taking the time to do this with me.
Jorge, it's always a pleasure. I thank you. This has been an interesting and lively discussion, and I appreciate everything that you do for Pituitary World News.
Well, thank you, Dr. Blevins. Again, this has been a great experience, and to our audience, we want to wish you a very, very happy holiday and a great Happy New Year to all of you. And stay tuned, a lot more coming in 2016.
So once again, thank you. It's my pleasure, and have a wonderful day.